Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
7 years ago, college wrestler Damien Hurd disappeared from a party in Gunnison, Colorado.
Everyone had been drinking or whatever, the usual party scene.
When, how, and why he left are questions I need your help to understand.
Nobody's heard from him.
No, it's just like he disappeared.
From Cold Case Productions and Podcast One, Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd. I'm your host, Claire Sanima. Join me April 20th for the season premiere.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Seth Partnow of The Athletic, and as you would expect for those of you who listen to podcasts with us, it's wide-ranging, goes through a lot of stuff in terms of what we're looking for over the last week of the regular season, moving forward, kind of takeaways from this weird part in the schedule, a little bit about our MVP theories and thoughts, and plenty of stuff in between. I mean, as you know, we go in a lot of different directions, so a little bit less than an hour. I hope you really enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me back, Danny.
This is such a strange time, not only in the NBA calendar more generally, but so specifically for this season. And the way I was thinking about it, and we talked about it a little bit before we started, is it's been such a long sprint. Like, I'm even thinking about this as an analyst, much less as a player or a coach. It's been such a long sprint since the All-Star break, and you know, a lot of these teams are making up games and everything else. And I'm sure there are tendencies, especially for the teams that have things more resolved, to be like, okay, it's over. This has been long enough. But there's also this weird dynamic that it is both the end of a long sprint, but also a lot of this stuff really matters, and we don't know how exactly it's going to matter until, you know, roughly a week from now.
Well, and even then, I mean, I think this is the lesserest, whatever. Like, confident I am in kind of how I think the playoffs are going to look any time that I can remember. Just with so many, you know, between the injuries and not really knowing what certain teams will look like. Like, I wrote on The Athletic this week with Alex Schiffer, like, the Nets have played, like, 0 minutes with, like, two of their, what I think are going to be kind of mainstay playoff lineups, which is their big three, and either Nick Claxton or Blake Griffin. Either of those four-person groups have shared the floor for 0 minutes this year. And I think that's pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, and I mean, to get into use some legal terms, there's an idea with certain evidence of whether it's more prejudicial than probative. And so that is basically the idea of, like, are you getting more out of it than it's biasing a jury in that sense? And, like, this year, figuring out what evidence is relevant for evaluating these teams is absolutely brutal. I mean, whether you want to talk about injuries or even one of the challenges that I've had at different moments in time, and I'm guessing teams have better measures of this than we do, is just remembering, okay, the Jazz played the 76ers in this game. Did Joel Embiid play? You know, like, was this player available? And also, like, did they play? Were they, you know, maybe hurt or coming back from something? This year has more context that can be easier to lose than any year I can remember. Because, like, even in the bubble, like, everybody kind of knew where things were.
Yeah, I mean, you say that the teams have better, but that stuff like that is so hard because the word you use is context. And, you know, to get measures of that, you need to pick out that context, and actually doing that in any sort of systematic way for a season like this. Like, what are your heuristics for a game that's, like, against the other teams, getting the other team's best punch? There's so many different ways to answer that question. And it might even differ for different opponents just based on matchups. So, I mean, I think even teams are going to struggle with that. And you know, it's easy to overweight kind of the small sample size of, like, the two or three season matchups. And I think that danger is even more present this year. Again, so how much does anything that has happened in the regular season tell us about the playoffs? I less than you would think.
Yeah.
Like, who is the most consistent team across this season has been the Suns.
I would agree.
But they are going in with you know, an almost unprecedented level of playoff inexperience for a team in that sort of position. And that, I think that matters. So, you know, you take, what have they done this season? But then, you know, other than Chris Paul and a little bit Jay Crowder, like, they don't have a lot of been there before.
Yeah, and even like, I mean, I know Monty has been on staffs and has all of it, but his experience as a playoff coach is not something that I remember particularly strongly. Like, the Pels made it one of the years that he was there. I think New Orleans made it twice when he was the coach. And so, like, yeah, there's a lack of coaching experience there too.
And not just coaching, but like organizationally.
Sure.
Like, Suns have not been in the playoffs for a while, and there's it's you know, I having experienced not just going to the playoffs, but like progressing in the playoffs for the first time in a while, it's just you're as much as you know it's going to be different, you're just not ready.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And for a lot of their important players, you know, like Devin Booker, and yes, he experienced the bubble, but that is different. You know, they didn't play in the playoff games within the bubble, and for Ayton and Mikhail Bridges, and it's going to be a lot for them to take on. And it seems that they're going to be facing a challenging opponent. I mean, that is one of the other really weird elements that I've been having to wrap my brain around. And I mean, we're recording this on Saturday, last night's Lakers-Blazers game. It didn't formalize that the Lakers are going to be the seven, because obviously they can make their way out, and there are numerous things they can do if they're a little bit better than their brethren. But I believe they now don't have the tiebreaker against both Dallas and Portland. And so that makes it hard for them to get at least to the five. And sure, there will be inevitably a shorthand that the Lakers are the defending champions, who have two players who, when healthy, can easily be the best player in the series, in any series they're playing in. But we don't know how those guys are going to be. We don't know how they're going to look. And so I talked a little bit about this with Matt Moore a couple weeks ago, about the idea of trust and what makes this year so distinct among all the ones since I've been covering the league is that the teams that you would otherwise have trust. So there are kind of three branches. One group of teams you don't trust because they're of their inexperience, and that's what you were getting at with Phoenix. Then there's another group of teams that you don't trust because of their history. And so you could bring up, you know, the Utah Jazz to an extent there. You could bring up the Clippers just because of how thoroughly they collapsed in that series against the Nuggets last year. And then the other one is health availability. And so for that, you could bring up the Nuggets because Jamal Murray is out. You could bring up the Lakers because we'll see what LeBron looks like and everything else. And basically, if you put those three boxes together, and of course, there's some teams that actually check multiple of those boxes just depending on who they have on the roster, there's basically no one left.
Yeah, it's the battle of wits scene in The Princess Bride, except there's like eight cups. So I can clearly not choose the one in front of you, or this other one, or this other one, or this other one. And so you just go in circles about why you can't pick any of the teams. And that's sort of where I feel right now, which is very odd.
And then the other huge wrinkle that comes in with it that I'm very excited about is that the top teams are getting a whole week off. And I think that it's very necessary after this year. I think that whether they have a lot of practices or more days off, or, you know, kind of a mix, maybe a light practice, something like that, I think that's going to be very good for those teams. And it will create a balance, though, of, you know, like, some of it is rest versus rust, but some of it is also just how you kind of can shift gears. And I'm wondering how teams are going to handle that. I think my general understanding is you deal with the road that's in front of you until the road in front of you changes. But for example, like, does Philadelphia, let's say they clinch the number one seed a couple of games before the end of the year, do they want to sit their best players to make sure that they're healthy and all that, if they know they're not playing for a week either way?
So I feel like the East and the West have a little bit of a different approach to this almost. Maybe the same approach, but a different set of worries. The one and two seeds in the East, maybe Washington is frisky just the way they've been playing, but you know you're going to get a favorable first round matchup.
You're going to have a talent advantage.
You know, you're going to have a talent advantage. So kind of the jumping on a moving treadmill thing is it's maybe not moving very fast. Whereas, like, you have a week off and here come the Lakers having just had to win a game to get into the playoffs. Like, that strikes me as a fundamentally different challenge. And I don't know how to prepare for that, because nobody does, because no one's ever done it.
Yeah. And the team, specifically the team that wins the 7-8 game, it's not like they're going to be exhausted. They will have played one game in a week. And if it's the team that was hosting that 7-8 game, they might not have even had to travel. And they'll have to travel to their first round opponent. But other than that, it should be okay. And yeah, I it's something that I've been trying to wrap my brain around. And I mean, after yesterday's result, it feels to me like the most likely does not mean definite. most likely situation is that the Warriors and Lakers are playing in the 7-8 playing game, and then the winner of that gets to face the two, and the loser of that game has to win another game, and the winner of that one faces presumably the Utah Jazz. And that is going to be a real challenge for those teams. And Utah does have, and also like the general understanding that the elevation advantage that Utah and Denver hold because of their elevation and everything else, that is muted to an extent in the playoffs. Well, also, you know, like how different is it with limited fans versus full fans and everything else. But yeah, those teams, you talked about the treadmill, like they're going to have to get on running pretty close to full speed, because depending on which, let's say we use the Lakers, depending on what version of the Lakers we're seeing, we could see a 2 seed or a 1 seed at a talent disadvantage.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, that is the biggest worry. And, you know, I don't think Golden State has the talent to have much of a chance of winning a first round series against those two. But then again, you know, the limited prep time is thinking, especially if they end up, you know, coming out as the 8 seed. The limited prep time for one of probably the harder guys to prep for in the league in Steph, like that's an interesting wrinkle too.
It's, well,
like
especially with Utah's
two games, yeah,
like Utah's personnel, in the sense that the Jazz have made a decision, and it's a worthwhile one. I think you make the argument, you know, you're always going to have to sacrifice something, where they have weaker perimeter defenders, but they have this unbelievable group of shooters and overall offensive players. And okay, how are you going to handle it if you have to face this game-breaking point guard who you can't do some of the normal defensive approaches on, and you don't have that same level of like defensive talent? It's going to, if that's the 1-8, it's going to be a real challenge.
I mean, I think they are. I mean, from a personnel standpoint, they're a little better equipped to handle Steph than they are to handle the Clippers or Lakers, I think.
Yeah, I would say that's fair, though we did see the Clippers struggle with, I mean, I think they, even though they're not trying to get all the way to the basket, we could see the rim protection affecting them a little bit.
Yeah.
But the Clippers might be having the greatest 3-point shooting season of all time. So they got plenty of shooters.
Yeah, so it's up to speed, and then you know, imagine if the first round series were 5 games, and you had a team like that had been going for, like, imagine what that first round series between the Lakers and Blazers would have felt like last year if it was a 5-game series after Portland wins game. No, I still think LA wins that series, because I think that Portland team had just given so much to even get that point that they were spent. But still, just the level of pucker, shall we say, that would happen in that kind of instance would be entertaining.
And I know there are people who have taken the widening gulf between the playoffs and the regular season to say that the regular season, you know, means less or something else. But it's like, I think it's worth appreciating just kind of as its own thing. And that's the way, you know, like, so I haven't fully finished my research yet, but like Jokic is probably going to be my MVP and a deserving one at that. And just because at this point, and
what else do you need to see? Hold on. Let's stop there. How is it even close?
I think I think for me with him and Curry, to me those are the two where I think Jokic has it. But for me, the argument of like which kind of offensive elevation is providing theoretically more value, and then you get into the interesting wrinkle of, is it better to be a below average defender at an important position or a like average defender at a less important position? Like, which is helping your team more? And like, it's more a thought experiment rather than like a data driven one, though I'm sure there's data that would help me. But for me, preliminarily, like on the research I've done, for me, it's Jokic and Curry, and then kind of this other group, which is a massive one. It's like 6 guys of other people who just don't have as strong a case, whether it be because the volume of games played isn't as much or because the impact per game is less.
Yeah. I mean, I think Curry is a reasonable shout here. The thing I would say is that it's hard for me to not speak in like 82 game, like, prorated. So I know that the totals won't be this year, but the going from 50 to 60 is a lot harder than going from 35 to 45 in terms of
that's true.
Of, you know, what your team is winning. So that's like the additional thing, like, you know, Jokic is digging out those harder additional wins also. And some of that is obviously having better teammates, but like, yes, he had better teammates and then he went and won the games that were harder to win still.
Yeah. I for me, part of the argument in favor, like part of the argument with Curry is just how, you know, like it's the degree of difficulty, like for a diver where the Warriors don't have the next yeah. best playmaker they have is somebody who would have significantly less utility were Steph Curry not on the team. And that's Draymond Green, who, like, you could see what happens to the Warriors offense when he plays without Steph. His limitations come more to the forefront. And while Jokic is, you know, he thrives and he does everything well, like, I think that he could work with less talented teammates. I think there's something to be said for, and I know there are people who don't like, I think of this as the Alex Rodriguez MVP argument going back to when he was on, I think he was on the Mariners and it was a team when they were like in last place or close to it. And it's like, it is true. And you're making the great point that 50 and 60 are not the same. But if it's 50 and 60 versus like 25 and 40, like that is a pretty significant difference too.
Yeah. We argue about this with our friend Kevin Pelton all the time. I think that team wins has to matter if we're talking about most valuable in a sport. Like, I think the biggest difference is the sport like baseball is like, okay, Alex Rodriguez did what he did, and that would be pretty agnostic of who else was on the team.
Yeah, that's a great argument, because in baseball, like you cannot come to bat more than once every nine times, and
right.
how often you get the ball in the field, who the hell knows? You know, it just depends. And whereas in basketball, you're impacting the game so much more. And so,
the best players matter. Just like, you know, this is an argument that what is the single most important position in sports? The finalists are like NFL quarterback, the hockey goalie, and NBA superstar. Like, not necessarily a position, but that role.
Yeah.
And like, okay, hockey goalies like are pretty random and can fluctuate very, very quickly. Maybe the very best quarterbacks win married with a great coach, but then just like I think the best basketball players like have more impact, and that's why like the team record, you know, it brings to bear on that, because there's so much that doesn't get picked up in like any of the real statistical measures we have, and it's just like, okay, they won a lot of games, and he's the reason why, and that factors in somewhere.
Oh yeah, it absolutely does. Since we kind of have gotten on this thread, something I've been, you know, the only thing about as I've done my research to grapple with is the difference between higher impact in fewer games and lesser impact in more time. So like, I mean, Joel Embiid is a good kind of catalyst for a lot of this stuff. I mean, there are numerous other players that you could go for, but I don't want to get into the specifics of this here unless you want to, but just speaking more generally, how do you approach it? Like, for, you know, for thinking about MVP, are you somebody who's more in the lines of like value is being on the court is valuable, and so if somebody if let's say somebody's lesser but has played 2,000 minutes versus somebody who's played 1,600 but was better?
So I think that for the person who's played significantly less, they have to have been clearly better. Like, you know, not just like, you know, a step better, you know, not just like marginally better. And I don't think there's not like, I don't like, you know, this has come up a lot in the last couple of weeks. I don't think there's a good argument that Embiid has been on a per game, per minute basis has been massively better. It's like maybe a little there here, a little there. Maybe you can make an argument that on, you know, per minute impact, he edges. But for, you know, with a big gap in minutes, it would have to be just obvious that he had been better while on the court. And you know, it's not close enough to meet that summary judgment standard, right? To go back to our legal training.
Well, and like, here's a way of thinking about it, or a way of articulating it. So far this year, as we're recording this podcast, Joel Embiid has played 1,500 minutes and Nikola Jokic has played 2,343. That means Embiid has played 65% of Jokic's minutes. He would have to be so much better to be more valuable in that much less time.
I mean, I think yes, and the ratio is the important. Like if Jokic had played 2600 and Embiid had played 2100, it's like, yeah, okay. You know, if a guy, you know, especially in a season like this, if a guy is getting held out of some back to backs, I'm not gonna go crazy about that in terms of. But it's just that difference in availability has just been so substantial that again, you would just need to be overpoweringly better. And you know, it's hard to mostly because of how good Jokic is. Like the number of seasons anyone has had that would have been enough better than Jokic to make up that kind of minutes difference is pretty small.
Yeah, and the other MVP related challenge that I've been having is not surprisingly related to Rudy Gobert, which is just I come at it many times in terms of like, you know, like Nate and I do top 10 players in the league and all that type of stuff, and in that sort of a project. I consider offense to be more valuable than defense, generating good shots. There, you know, team, the difference of how you can create a team defense versus individual stuff. But MVP is a regular season award. It is not tied to who you think is the best player in the league at the moment. It is not based on how successful they're going to be in the playoffs. And also, while it is true that you can succeed defensively in a variety of ways, it is also true that the Utah Jazz have primarily chosen to succeed on defense via funneling everything to Rudy Gobert and having Gobert clean it up, and it has worked exceedingly well. So I don't think he has, to me, especially given his modest role on offense, like I don't think Gobert has a, you know, 17% usage.
Well, let's stop there.
Sure.
I think so. So he is not he's not a fulcrum of their offense, but he is a driver of their offense.
Yeah, he is definitely a value. You know, he is a value add, and he does help. And he's more like that might understate it to an extent.
Yeah, I think the better like is to his offensive value is probably comparable to, you know, the best years of say a Kyle Korver or a JJ Redick in terms of their ability to draw attention and create defensive movement without the ball. You know, it was in those Hawks teams with Korver, like the Korver assist where he'd like, you know, come off a wide pin and his guy would and Millsap's guy or something would like shade up and then Millsap would slip to the basket and get a layup. And like Korver never touches the ball, but he made that. And yeah. So much of like the Jazz's blender is they run just a variety because they can run. They have, you know, four or five guys who can run a pick and roll. And so they from a variety of angles, and Gobert's diving to the basket and he draws attention and then someone else is attacking a closeout. Now, if that's, you know, last year's team, that's Tony Bradley, or even if that's Derek Favors this year, it doesn't create the same advantage. And they have a lot of guys who play very well with an advantage. Like Joe Ingles isn't going to break anybody down off the dribble. But if you give Joe Ingles a defender closing out on him, you know, that's he's going to do some things. And so Gobert is, you know, I'm not going to say he's, you know, the driving force in their offense, but his kind of rim running gravity creates a lot of that.
And as you said, the blender doesn't work nearly as well without him. So then that's another way of thinking about it. So then where do you think Gobert fits in this conversation then?
I haven't, other than knowing it's Jokic one, I haven't, you know, really looked at where else. I think he would be challenging for a spot on the back of my ballot.
I'm not sure that he would be there. Yeah, I haven't finished my work yet, but I have this group kind of, I think it's from 3 to 8, and I'm still sorting out I also don't think that the order is too, you know, like it matters obviously for various things, but it's like,
yeah,
you know, it's the way that I think about tiers. It's like my rule for tiers is that you can make a credible argument for any order. And once you can make a credible argument, I stress a little bit less about the order, especially because I don't have an actual ballot. Like if I had an actual ballot, I'd have sleepless nights.
Right. By the way, would you ever want it? I have no desire.
I would
actually never have a ballot.
I would like one. The idea behind it basically being, I would want a ballot. You could sort of think about this the way I think about it as like an expansion franchise. I would want it if I think I would be in the top half of informed voters. So like if I'm elevating the level of the voting group, then I want it because then it makes the voting better. And I, you know, so it's like adding an expansion franchise to Seattle. It actually improves the overall league financial stuff because Seattle is going to be a higher revenue team than the average team in the league. So if I'm above that threshold, which I believe I am, then, yeah, sure.
Release the Kraken, Danny.
also, yes, very much so. And so that's kind of the idea to me. And yeah, I know that there are lobbying and other things that come from that. And I don't know, I'm pretty, coming from some of the stuff in my background, like I'm pretty good at ignoring people who want me to do certain things that I don't want to do. Like, that's just something I'm used to. And I'm used to telling people, like, you know, like ignoring publicity, please, if that's, or like, or, you know, lightly considering them. But it isn't, there was a time earlier in my career where I felt more aggressive about it, where I was like, I really want it, and doing all that. And it's like, and also, like, the other thing that has happened is the awards that have been given out that I disagreed with in the last few years haven't been high-end awards. They haven't been things that mattered too much to me. Like, if there were a year where I thought there was a clear MVP and that person didn't win, then I would feel much more zealous about trying to get a ballot and thinking. But, I mean, hopefully there's some ways of changing the discourse using the public means that I have and everything else. But I would rather have one than not, but I don't think I would, it's not like something I would go crazy to get. But yeah, it's interesting, but yeah, with the volume of stuff of the league that I watch and think about and everything like that, you know,
sure.
I'd like to think sure. That'd be in the top half. It'd be nice.
Sure. I would not want one, not because I don't think I would have informed votes. It's more that having been on the other side, I kind of, the impact that such things actually, those things actually carry weight in terms of people making decisions and how the league works.
Oh, for sure.
And it's just like, and it's, so there's a little bit of that, you know, the uncertainty principle.
But here's the thing for me. I would rather have, so if I believe I'm in the top half, the reason I would take a ballot is that I think I'd be giving those players and people a better shot. Like, that's the, that would sure. be my idea behind it, would be if, you know, you already brought up Joe Ingles. Like, I think that me having a vote would make it more likely that Joe Ingles, who I feel is, as of right now, the deserving sixth man of the year, it'd make it more likely that he wins. And so, good.
Seems like the momentum is breaking that way.
Good.
Like, Clarkson has fallen off, and people are like, holy crap, look at Joe Ingles' true shooting.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and that's the other thing that happens is, like, so people, I mean, this comes up, you know, Nate and I, in various forms, we're interacting with fans constantly. People think a lot about awards and narrative long before decisions are actually made. And that is an important distinction to make, is that, like, yes, there was this thought and that Jordan Clarkson seemed like the favorite and everything else, but that doesn't matter. It matters, let's say, like, a third as much or half as much when nobody can put pen to paper, you know, when it's the, because, so, I mean, priors matter. Obviously they do. Like, there are myriad examples where you can point to a prior mattering, or somebody was hot for the first few weeks and then they tailed off. I mean, all those sorts of things absolutely do happen. But as long as people who vote take their vote seriously, like, you don't end up with the wrong answer too often. And I know that there are all these funny things that happen. Like, to me, the biggest kind of, like, fallacies that fans get into is, like, I mean, Harden fans got into this when Westbrook won the MVP over him. It's like, Westbrook was better that year. That doesn't mean Russell Westbrook was, or he was more valuable. That doesn't mean that.
Okay.
In my opinion.
He was, okay. Another time we can relitigate that.
But that Harden, let's say theoretically, Harden being a better player subsequently does not affect whether that award was properly given.
That's true.
That is a completely separate point of whether this player is a better player or not.
Yeah, we see this, and we see that sort of silliness every year. And it's like, oh, is that your MVP in the playoffs? It's like, well, these games don't count for that.
Yeah, and it's
like,
and it, I would be in firm support of having some sort of different award that encompasses other things, like whether it be you get a Conn Smythe
player of the year,
Conn Smythe. I mean, Pelton does the, I don't know if he calls it the basketball door, but, like, basically the idea of calendar year. I support all those
basketball
things.
Basketball door, I like that. That's great. I'm stealing that.
Got it. I mean, you have to ask KP, but I'll give you my part of it. I think that there, and I know that the league kind of in some ways doesn't want that, because if you did something that was the whole year, including the playoffs, it would have an obvious, not bias, but weight towards the playoffs and a recency bias and everything else. But
what's wrong with that?
Yeah, having something
right.
Yeah. And it would also, I especially in some ways when the league does the award ceremony kind of after everything, which I mean, I don't think it's necessary,
sucks.
But they do what they're going to do. I think embracing that to add a component, like for me, the one that would be the most beneficial to add would be the playoff MVP or MOP or however you wanted to do it. And yeah, it would often end up like it would sometimes go to a finals MVP and all that. But there are other times where it would kind of open up the field to be like, okay, this was the best player during the finals, but this guy had an awesome run. They helped the team get there. And there are also circumstances where I think a player on an eliminated team, whether they were eliminated in the finals or something earlier, if they were really good, that it gives them a way to like something else to quantify, to point to, that would be useful.
Right. I would not be opposed to an all tournament team.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought the all bubble team was a nice touch last year.
Absolutely, yeah. You could work something like that. I'm sure the eventual champion would probably be a little bit overrepresented. That's okay. I don't think that's the worst. I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. How do you feel? Just because I was thinking about my all defensive teams. I've broadly been in the boat that the way they should resolve like the all NBA and that is one backcourt player, one frontcourt player, and three wild cards. I think that for all NBA and all defensive, basically to open up the field a little bit more so that if there were multiple good players of the same kind of grouping that they would be allowed? Or do you think the more restrictive is better?
More restrictive is better because, I mean, really, from a defensive value standpoint, you'd end up with two guards and eight centers.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that.
Do
you really want more than two guards? Really?
Well, I mean, no, but if you're like, okay, if you call like Jimmy Butler or Matisse Thybulle guards, then like, you know, you're, you know, the, it's going to go, it can go to some bigger guards. It's just, I can't even think of who like the seventh best defensive center this year has been, like Robin Lopez or something like that has been like really good for Washington. So, you know, if you start to go down to who's been the seventh best defensive center, it's like, how much does that really like reflect the season? If you're, you know, a guy who's like, yeah, he's in the top quarter of defenders at his position. So he's on the all defense team. I suppose it depends on what these awards are for. And I think it is who the goal is, like, you know, back retrospectively, who were the best players this year. And, you know, again, I don't think going down that deep in a position serves that goal especially well.
That's fair. I respect that. But yeah, and the other danger that I know is going to come this year is that we have all of these pieces of uncertainty. You and I have already talked about a lot of them with health and everything else, that you have to narrow all of those uncertainties into one result, whether that is a specific game, a specific series, the whole playoffs, the whole thing. And that will lead to the perception of like that this was the only way it was going to go. Of like, let's say the Nets and the Lakers or the Nets and the Clippers face off. It was all about talent, and these teams are there.
Narrative determinism,
exactly. Versus yeah. I will try to do my part to not do that. But I worry a little bit about that, especially because the playoffs take so much time that you kind of work past parts of it to get to the next parts of it. And so especially if a team gets knocked out early, that their story is just kind of not a part of it anymore.
Yeah. No, I think just analogizing to the draft is probably a good rule of thumb here. I think at this point people realize enough that, you know, aside from the top couple guys, landing in the spot matters a great deal to how you turn out. And so it's like, well, he was always going to be a blah, blah. Like Draymond was always going to be, you know, one of the defensive legends. Like, you know, there's a lot of places he ends up where he never gets higher than like a feisty eighth man, right? And so the backwards looking thing, like, oh, everyone should have known because look how he turned out, is silly. And I feel kind of the same way about the playoffs. Like, you know, Mike Conley's shot in game seven against Denver goes in last year, you know, butterfly effect being what it is. Do the Clippers beat the Jazz? Maybe. And then it's just a huge butterfly flap swings moment. And so many of those things, you know, happen, you know, that the Milwaukee wins the game against Miami where they called like the multiple last second fouls, like that goes the other way somehow. And does that series turn out? And then how are we feeling about, you know, the various narratives? So I do kind of reject the narrative determinism that that the path we chose was the only one it could have been.
Yeah, and I'm hopeful that we can move in that in that direction, both, you know, individually, but also collectively as basketball media. I mean, that would be my hope. And I'm also like, I mean, the Denver Nuggets in certain ways are such a challenging part of that when they have the likely and also the deserving most valuable player, Jokic, but because they're one of their other important players, Jamal Murray, is out, like it makes them more beatable. Whether they actually win or lose the first round, we don't know. But the Nuggets, let's say they lose in the first round, that in no way makes Nikola Jokic's regular season any less special.
He is kind of on a free roll.
I would agree.
Like, and he's earned that, but because he's been great in the playoffs in the past as well. So, you know, it's really only upside in the postseason for Jokic, just because, you know, I would have frankly had.
But well, this, so well, wait, let's clarify that. Do you think that for the two of us? Do you think that for the general fan? Or for the average media member? Not that you have to put yourself in their place, but my instinct is that I think you accurately reflected my interpretation, but I don't know if that is reflective of the larger populace.
I mean, you know, I was going to say it would be pretty hypocritical. It's like, oh, they're done because Jamal Murray's out, and then they lost. See, that proves. It's like, wait, no, you just said they were done when Jamal Murray's out, and now you can't. Oh, it doesn't. Those are inconsistent anyway. But of course, that wouldn't stop anyone from, you know. That might be more us than general, but certainly from how I'm looking at it, Jokic is on a free roll. Like, I would have, you know, he would have had much more on the line, like from almost a legacy standpoint. If Murray had been healthy, I would have picked them to win the title had they gotten into the playoffs that way. Yeah, no, I was in. Like, you know, the Aaron Gordon trade was, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I was kind of thinking that we would look back at it in retrospect as kind of like the Rasheed Wallace trade, because it just kind of, oh, everything fits just perfectly now. And for that, you know, that 10 days or so where they had that, like, they were frightening. And so sadly, we're not going to see that in the playoffs this year. And so, you know, the expectations change. But so it's almost like the only thing they could possibly do is exceed them.
Yeah. And I've been incredibly impressed with how they've played after Jamal went down. And when you consider the further context of all the other injuries that they're dealing with, including Monte Morris being out, like to be able to succeed with this few creators is a triumph of coaching, of players, of everything else. And I would say in some ways the good news for the Nuggets is that for beyond the kind of the free roll element, that's a silver lining, but it is a silver lining, is I'm guessing based on what's happened the last couple of days that they're going to face a less dangerous opponent in the first round. And so like if it's a free roll and if they can make it out of the first round, then that would be an important statement as well.
The other, you know, for doing silver linings thing, the other thing for Denver is it has pushed Michael Porter Jr.
Yes.
into a different. I've been, you know, I've been a somewhat vocal Michael Porter Jr. skeptic at times, and oops. So it's you know, him like kind of moving up the pecking order slowly, and now like taking over a little bit, like filling in like admirably as that like secondary like pair guy with Jokic since that injury has been really impressive.
Yeah, I'll put some of the stats on Michael Porter Jr. I'll use since the All-Star break. It's not exactly a proxy, but you know, it gets us close enough to there.
Yeah, I am going to be writing about this week about kind of his change role since the Murray injury, just in terms of how much more on ball responsibilities he's gotten and how that sort of cascaded throughout his game.
Yes. So since the All-Star break. Usage up from 20% to 23%, and that's gone even higher since the injury. 68% true shooting, 46% from three, taking about 6.5 per game. And yeah, if you look at the splits, be it, you know, like if you were to do it from the narrower thing, which I don't have the time to do on the fly, I'm not as adept at that as some people are. It'd be even more striking. And yeah, I mean, Porter Jr. potentially taking those steps forward, I think that is incredibly impressive and significant long term. And yeah, I mean, we'll see what we can get from those guys. Hopefully they can, you know, Monte and some of the other guys can come back. I've liked Campazzo, of course, as I have for quite some time now. And I wonder, yeah, just what it's going to be for them. And the other kind of element this is coming up in terms of people kind of talking about the series they wanted is that I know there are people, and I I'm not vehemently against this. Like, so there have been some people, there are some people who like exciting first round series. And for me, I'm happy to have it chalk or chalky in the first round to set up juicier second round and conference finals. So like the idea, let's say, I mean, the thing about like what is maximum chaos. And for me, that's a Lakers Clippers first round series. But that's also why I don't want to see a Lakers Clippers first round series. I'd rather see it in the second or third round.
Well, again, I think there's a difference in conference. I think the first round series in the West are going to be like spicy. And the first round series in the East, like, okay, if it's, you know, Knicks and whoever and the 4-5 will be fun. And then, you know, from a standpoint of narrative enjoyment, like Knicks and the one seed would probably be the ideal. And then, you know, the two of three of Philly, Milwaukee and Brooklyn who don't finish first in the other one. Like that's that side. But then the West, like, you know, first week and a half of the playoffs, let's watch the late games. And then the second round, let's watch the early games, and we'll be in the conference finals. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking like Bucks Nets in the second round, because the Sixers have the benefit of now they've cleared a little bit of gap in terms of record, but also they just have this comically easy schedule to end the year. And so I think they'll be able to push. The Jazz have something kind of similar, but they're still dealing with some absences, so they're more beatable. And also the Suns are pushing harder. Like, I mean, the Suns, this kind of gets lost in the shuffle sometimes. They have the second best record in the whole NBA, not just the second best record in the Western Conference.
Yeah, no, and again, they have been, you know, they kind of were a little up and down at the very start of the season. And since then, they have been, I would the most consistently high level team in the league.
Yeah, and that's, and Nate brought this up. I had completely forgotten about this, that kind of the opposite to some extent of that. And there's, of course, a ton of context that goes in here. Would be the Orlando Magic, who I had completely forgotten started the year 6-2, and then have been decidedly less than 6-2 since then.
I mean, some things happened.
Yeah, well, and also like some of the teams that they beat early, like they beat the Wizards twice early when the Wizards were significantly worse than they are now. Yeah. Though Cleveland
when the
was
Wizards,
better.
When the Wizards' interior defense was Thomas Bryant and Mo Wagner.
Yes.
So
they're 6-2 at the beginning of the season, the Magic, and then they're 15-44 since.
Some of that is by choice, but
yes. Oh, and that's kind of like the other crazy thing. I brought this up somewhere recently. It will change a lot over the next 6 to 7 days. But the insanely weird element that right now, so the Houston Rockets are going to be clear of everybody else for the worst record in the NBA, and that makes them extremely likely to keep their own, well, not extremely likely, it makes it 50-50 basically that they will keep their first round pick this year. After them, you have the Cavs, the Pistons, the Wolves, the Thunder, and the Magic, all of whom currently on 538's Raptor projection, which remember, these teams are only playing roughly 5 more games the rest of their season. All of them are projected to finish 22-50. And the ripple effects in terms of basically every permutation off of that are completely bonkers when you consider that there are protected picks in this range. The Timberwolves are probably the most prominent in this. Like, that changes the arc not only of their franchise, but potentially of the Warriors / whoever the Warriors could theoretically trade that pick to if they ended up wanting to trade that pick. Like, it is so big, and I
you know what the maximum chaos result is, don't you? The Bulls win the lottery.
I think maximum chaos is the Pelicans win the lottery, personally.
The Pelicans win the lottery, and we get a new round of lottery reform.
Yeah. Which incidentally, it's exactly what happens. Yeah. I mean, yes.
Yeah. No, exactly.
I wrote about that in my Warriors book. It's like, because, and this lottery reform hadn't happened yet. It's like, that lottery reform happened because the Orlando Magic, who weren't particularly, like, they weren't terrible, won the lottery 2 years in a row and ended up with Shaq and Penny, and everybody's like, maybe we shouldn't do this anymore. And then they shifted, and then the process shifted it back the other way.
Well, and then the Cavs won, you know, multiple years in a row.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and then, you know, trade for LeBron, yada, yada, yada. Now, one of them... No, they won and drafted Anthony Bennett, so, but, you know, they still won the lottery.
In that draft, that was, you know, I mean, yeah, no, I think I had Nerlens number one in that class, and, you know, he's having a wonderful year this year, but it's taken some time.
Yeah, no, that was a mess of the draft at the top. I mean, obviously, like, well, how come nobody thought about drafting Giannis at first? It's like, yeah, okay.
I mean, I had Giannis, I think, 8th, and that was about the highest I saw anybody. And I had barely watched, I hadn't watched that much film of him. I'm just like, I had a specific theory of that year's draft. I mean, my stuff at Real GM, I think, is still there. The formatting might be a little wonky after all these years, but I think it's still there. My theory of, was that 2011?
so long ago. Sounds right.
That was 2013. Okay, so my theory of the 2013 draft was everybody's floor is low, everybody's expected value is low, so just draft on ceiling. And honestly, that ended up being not too bad that year. Like, basically the idea is, like, most of these guys aren't going to be good. So let's, so just take the guy who could end up being the best. And so, yeah, I had Nerlens high. I had Gobert high. I've always loved Rudy Gobert. And, yeah, so the Bulls pick, just so people have it, it's top four protected, which is, so, I mean, there can be pretty significant chaos even if they don't get the number one.
But them jumping just because it, like, it now there's less spots for Minnesota and
Houston
and Houston too. Yeah.
Also on that, you know, I'm a pick protection maven, of course. The Minnesota pick is only top three protected. So there's some craziness that could happen there too. I mean, the possibility of the Warriors getting the fourth or fifth pick in what a lot of people think is a five player top or second tier, depending on how you feel about Cade Cunningham, is also insane. Of course, last year they did that, and I think they chose wrong. We'll see how that works out. And teams do that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the toughest thing is I think they chose wrong too. But like, I just trying to put myself in the shoes of, they've had this plan, and the morning of the draft, it blows up. And you're not even sure what exactly the thing is. I mean, because, you know, Clay hurt himself, like, late morning of draft day.
Yeah.
And just, you know, you do scenarios.
And it wasn't at the facility or anything else. It was, I mean, I think they had an idea, but...
Yeah, but you run, you know, all kinds of scenarios and do mocks and stuff like that. I don't know how you prepare for that. So,
yeah.
Like, you know, cold light of day, like even if you're a fit guy, the reasons to not draft LaMelo kind of evaporate. But it's just like, at that point, it's just so hard. I have a hard time seeing someone who would be able to, in that amount of time, coherently, like, upend the strategy that they've been spending weeks building.
And that's also, though, a part of why I am pretty zealously, you know, best prospect available. You don't, because other things can change so quickly, and because it is extremely rare for young players to actually contribute early. But the biggest argument that I've always made in terms of this is, you take the best player because it's most likely that they're going to hold their value. You know, like, I know there are arguments like, oh, why is he, like, he's a center, big guys always do it. It's like, better players generally hold their value more than inferior guys. Something interesting, I'm looking at the 2013 draft. I mean, we're years and years out from this. The guys are on their third contracts. I mean, Nerlens Noel is probably on his fourth or fifth. Anthony Bennett is the only player taken before 14, and who knows, maybe at some point Shabazz Muhammad is back in the league, who is not currently in the NBA.
That, I, you know, that's really interesting.
Like, I mean, a lot of them don't have amazing careers, you know, like Alex Len and Ben McLemore, Trey Burke have bounced around a lot, but they're still around. Like, that is an uncommonly high, you know, like, it's kind of like star, I often use the term like star starters and rotation players, and it's like, that class is pretty, well, I mean, it ends up being okay in terms of stars with Giannis and Gobert, and at a time, Oladipo. But, I mean, that's kind of impressive. So if you want to compare that to, well, I guess, so if you look at 14, Stauskas is out of the league, Vonleh is kind of out of the league, and that's really about it there. And Jabari Parker has bounced a little bit, and we don't know what's going on with Exum. I guess Exum might be on his way out, but hopefully he's not. Yeah. Hopefully it's just that this calf issue just took him out for this year. I mean, I still think there's a good player in there. And then if you went beyond that, there are other players there. But it's like, yeah,
sure.
Let's call that a small victory for the much maligned, deservedly so, 2013 draft class.
Or a measure of how strong the lottery pick halo effect is.
Also true. Yeah. Yeah, that is
Ben McLemore has turned himself into a serviceable NBA player over the years. I think because of where he was drafted, he's gotten more chances. And that, you know, that's how it works. Like, you know, it may be like some of that is, it even makes sense because the things that made him get drafted at that point are the things you can say, well, maybe if we can unlock that. But still, I do think that you know, if he was a talented player who had, you know, let's put it this way, someone who was picked 30th, like Kevin Porter Jr., would not have gotten the number of chances that McLemore has. And I think that like on talent coming into the draft, they were probably comparable.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
It's a player comp nobody has ever made.
No.
It wasn't really a player comp. It was a situational comp.
Situational comp.
Yeah.
I think where I kind of want to end with this is we're now 1 week out from the end of the regular season. We're, let's call it, a week and a half from the first play-in of this iteration. What teams are you watching? What are you looking for?
Man, that's a tough question. Mostly because, again, I don't know what anyone's going to show me over the next week that's going to tell me anything, that's going to make me feel more confident about anything. You know, but it was James Harden get back on the floor and how he looks. Maybe that's something. You know, LeBron gets back on the floor shows something that, like, I guess those will tell me some things. So I guess, I mean,
the other one is Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if you're going to make me pick, like, those are like the players kind of coming back and getting back on the floor are the ones that are most worth watching. And, you know, we've actually been, you know, one of the benefits of the compressed schedule is, even though there's been a lot of blowouts, because there's so many games every night, that there's been most nights it seems like there's been one or two really good games.
Yeah,
like it ended up being you know, Phoenix kind of put it away a little bit late, but that was a really good game for, I don't know, three quarters and a bit.
And I wouldn't necessarily say it was a good game, but New Orleans Philly was a close game. It was a sloppy as hell game, and there was
the main event there was Griff's press conference, I think.
Yeah, I think that too. And Lonzo Ball somehow throwing who is such a talented passer, throwing two passes off shins on the final two possessions of the game. Like, that's not something you see very often. And yeah, I mean, they come from all over. Sometimes it's the big national games. And the other thing that I'm looking for, and I brought this up earlier, is this is probably, and it's anomalous because of how compressed the schedule is, though Evan Wash would say that it's not, you know, like we did that, Nate and I did that interview with him, and this is fair, that it's not, in some ways it feels more compressed than it is numerically, but how these top teams, the teams that are getting a week off, how they approach the end of the year. Now, I have long believed that was more about injury risk mitigation rather than, you know, like fatigue, but I could be wrong. I could very well be wrong, and I don't know if these teams are going to want to kind of, like, some of them are going to want to run through the tape, whether they're going to want to give their guys some rest. And so, like, one of my operating theories has been, like, once Philly clinches the one seed, maybe they play Embiid and Simmons in games, but they do, like, a couple of five-minute bursts rather than, like, the full game.
No, I think if you're going to do that, you might as well just hold them out. Just part of that is like, you know, okay, the minutes are whatever, but you got to, you know, whatever the minute load is, you got to tack X number of minutes on just for suiting up for, like, the active warm up and then the cool down afterwards and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, that's
so, like, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's like the idea people, and I remember I was like this before I kind of started talking to people more often, of the, why don't you just, why is it that teams, like, never bring their starters back? You know, it's, why are they so reluctant to pull their starters when they, and instead of just potentially bringing them back in? It's like, because there are all these things that happen, and it's like, it's a lot harder to do that. And so your mindset of, if you're not playing in a game at all versus if you're playing a little bit, is very different.
Yeah, no, I think if you're going to, like, if you're going to try to rest guys, actually rest guys again. Like, guys do. So this is something that they hear players talk a lot about later in their careers. Like, Dirk talked about this a lot later in his career, is it wasn't the games so much. It was everything he had to do between the games to be able to play in the games.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of that kind of maintenance and ramp up that if you can give, okay, no, just, get out in the court, shoot your jumpers, get in the training room, do that stuff. If you can do that and sort of resolve for a week, like, I think that would be probably the way I would do it, instead of trying to, well, we're just going to play him 18 minutes tonight.
Mm-hmm. And the other factor that's been in that, another one of those, you don't see it, so we often don't think about it as much as the players and the coaches do, is how much the protocols are taking out of them. I mean, you have, like, all the testing and all of the, you know, having to go in and all the restrictions that many teams are facing, you know, trying to do everything. And so, like, when you're traveling and everything else. And so all of that is kind of weighing on everything as well.
Sure.
Yeah, it's going to be... I'm very interested. Like, one of the other parts of this that we're obviously not going to see for a little while now is how the season. I'm guessing players are just going to be so thrilled next season if, like, basically they can live their lives again. Hopefully they can. I mean, we don't know where the world is going to be in October of 2021, but hopefully we're at that point. And I think for the playoffs, I don't know what the testing regime is going to be. I don't know what the vaccination numbers are like for each organization. I know there are thresholds where the things get less onerous, but yeah, I mean, and whether that affects the timeline, like, oh, if I'm going to have to go into the facility a couple hours early anyway, even if I'm not playing, or maybe you just say when you're not coming into the arena at all today, maybe they don't have to go through. I don't know all of those nuances.
Yeah, those are good questions too, actually. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that either.
Yeah. Well, we will learn a lot over the course of the next week. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Seth for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic. You can also listen to the Nerder She Wrote podcast. And very excited that his manuscript was just finished. I don't know publication timeline or anything with his book, but I've read part of it. I'm extremely excited to read the rest of it and for everybody else too as well. And of course, you can follow Seth on Twitter if you don't already, at Seth Partnow, SethPartnow. Love having him on and getting his perspective and working through some of the stuff with the Jokic's MVP case and everything else. You know, I'm not all the way through all my research. Nate and I will do awards pretty soon. Not all the way there. If you want to support this podcast, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode. That is particularly good with Real GM Radio because it will never come out on a specific day of the week. It's just going to be when I'm available, my guests are available. So you can't get in the habit. So subscribe. That way it'll pop into your podcast player whenever you're ready for it, whether it's Spotify, Apple, wherever. And also you can help other people find the show. That is word of mouth or leaving a rating and a review, and that helps other people find the show, whether you like a specific episode or the show in general. And you can also check out the other work that I do. Nate Duncan and I are doing the last of our League Pass NBA cast that will be this week because there is no more League Pass after this week. It will be all on National and all that fun stuff. And so you can watch that. And then Nate and I will be doing the more kind of quote-unquote traditional, because it started first, NBA casts are where you have to kind of sync up with us. Those will be starting next week, actually. Those are starting pretty soon. And just trying to get back into form, and we'll have that ready before the play-in, but we'll probably do probably regular season game or two. And Nate and I also doing Dunked On. The single episode per week is Sunday night / Monday morning. We're actually going to do awards for this one, and then Dunked On Prime is the rest of the week, and you can check that out, of course. And we also do the locker room conversations on Tuesdays, and that's always a lot of fun. You can get the, we like to think of it like a call-in radio show, and release that as a podcast as well for those of you who can't be with us live. Also, if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise. I'll try to get back to you. I'm admittedly not as great about that, but I do read everything. It comes in. It's just about, you know, I want to give things a good thought. Before I respond, if I do. And not everything requires one. Sometimes people are just like, hey, do this. I consider it and everything else. But that is enough for now. Thank you all so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.